Crusade Channel News. News you can trust, because the truth can be trusted. From the Crusade Channel News Desk, here's Celeste Youngblood.
Good afternoon, Crusaders. This is Celeste Youngblood coming to you from the Veritas Radio Network News Bureau with your headlines at this hour on this Thursday, January 4th, 2017. A gene therapy for blindness has been approved by the FDA, but affordability remains problematic. Then I'll have your stock market report and saint of the day. Former Senator Ron Paul says that economic progress under President Trump is an illusion and that a crash is on the way. Tragedy struck at a train crossing in South Africa. And the president is threatening his former White House chief strategist, Steve Bannon. Luxturna is a new gene therapy which was developed to treat progressive blindness and received FDA approval last year. The condition it treats is an inherited genetic disease resulting from mutations in the RPE65 gene. Only a few thousand people in the United States are affected by it. The gene mutation disrupts the cells located near the retina, causing the victim to gradually lose their vision. Luxturna therapy involves the injection of a modified adeno-associated cold virus into the eye to deliver the correct genes to the retina. Here is the story of one young man who has benefited from Luxturna therapy, courtesy of NBC News.
When 17-year-old Christian Guardino appeared on America's Got Talent, he was more than a star. He was a medical miracle.
Just was like one of the biggest wow moments I think that I've ever had in my entire life. The gene therapy changed my life completely.
Christian was born with a genetic defect making him go blind.
It was so difficult to watch him not even be able to navigate his home surroundings at times and knock into walls.
He became one of the first to try an experimental gene therapy to reverse blindness. Doctors inject directly into the eye a normal gene to fix the defective gene.
You're delivering this gene, which sets up shop and delivers the therapeutic molecule continually, so that you don't have to take a pill every day or take an eye drop every day.
Scientists believe one day this approach could treat other conditions caused by genetic defects, like certain cancers, heart disease, and Parkinson's.
Before the trial, any options, any hope?
The option was to sit and watch his world go completely black, or try to trust science a little bit.
Within 24 hours, a dramatic change.
They removed the patch. And then he said, "Mom, is that you and Papa sitting over there?"
4 years later, Christian could see the crowd's reaction that night. And today, doctors see the future of gene therapy. Dr. John Torres, NBC News, Patchogue, New York.
Of the 21 volunteers who signed up to try Luxturna, nearly all of them had their vision loss reversed almost immediately. This is all good news. However, there is one factor which will create issues for those who wish to avail themselves of Luxturna in the future, and that factor is cost. Spark Therapeutics, the company which manufactures Luxturna, says that it costs $425,000 per eye for the treatment, meaning that it will cost $850,000 to treat both eyes. Spark Therapeutics has worked out deals with an insurance company, a pharmacy benefit manager, and is negotiating with the federal government to find ways to help patients cover the costs of Luxturna. The difference between Luxturna and other medications is that whereas a pharmaceutical company can make money through patients taking their medications over an extended period of time for chronic conditions, Luxturna is a one-time medication. Dr. Steve Miller, Chief Medical Officer of Pharmacy Benefits Manager Express Scripts, told CNBC, quote, "It's wildly expensive, but to be very frank, I think they've priced it what I'll call responsibly. The product is just phenomenally innovative, and we've been talking about gene therapy for over 20 years. We're now at the threshold of having gene therapy reaching patients." Dr. Miller continued, "We've got to figure this out because, let's be frank, there are going to be more of these drugs coming to the marketplace for even bigger populations." David Mitchell, president of Patients for Affordable Drugs and a sufferer of incurable blood cancer, said, quote, "Luxturna offers hope to hundreds of patients, but the question that must be asked is this. What is a fair price that will maximize affordability and accessibility and provide a reasonable return for the drug? The answer to that is certainly not the $850,000 price tag announced today." P. Peter Mybarduk of Public Citizen is calling for Spark Therapeutics to, quote, disclose its research and development costs for Luxturna so that analysts, payers, and the public have a basis to assess Spark's decision. He insists that if insurance companies cover expensive therapies such as Luxturna, that premiums will rise across the board, and warns that the Trump administration needs to establish, quote, basic disciplines for medicine affordability. Mybarduk says that Spark Therapeutics CEO Jeffrey Marazzo's comments defending the steep price of Luxturna are absurd and obscene, and claims the pricing stems from nothing but greed. In a statement full of generalities but no specifics, Marazzo said, quote, "We have been working with stakeholders across the healthcare sector to help ensure that appropriate patients have access to a product that challenges all of the current conventions of how patients are treated, how products are delivered, and how payments are handled. Over these past few months, we have been working with health insurers to create innovative pathways for access to Luxturna that may serve as models for other one-time administered gene therapies in the future." Well, let's hope so. And now it's time for your business and market report. Oil prices have hit their highest in over 2.5 years as a result of the unrest in OPEC's third largest producer of oil, Iran. Reuters' Kate King has more.
Oil prices hitting fresh highs on Thursday, with benchmark Brent crude topping $68 a barrel, a level not seen since May 2015. The main reason? This. Anti-government protests in Iran, OPEC's third biggest producer. The country's Revolutionary Guard has been deployed to try and shut down the demonstrations, which are fueled by rising living costs and frustration with the political system. Iran's inflation is at 9.6%, while its unemployment rate sits at 12.5%.
Markets have been reminded about the geopolitical threats within the region, and of course that always has a catalyst to provide a boost to the oil price. I think now that we're back at the sort of levels that we were seeing in mid-2015, the debate is whether we should and will see further price gains from here.
Many analysts agree the unrest is unlikely to affect oil supply unless oil field workers go on strike. Since crippling sanctions over Iran's nuclear program were lifted, it's restored oil production to nearly 4 million barrels a day, yet it's failed to deliver an economic boom. And if the recent rally was to persist, it's possible that Iran will be tempted to cash in on it by increasing exports, in spite of the current OPEC restrictions, which have also been supporting prices.
We are seeing some signs of a rundown in global inventories, but then again, that's what the authorities have been aiming to achieve. And I don't think necessarily the current demand-supply imbalances would suggest the necessity or requirement for oil prices to move substantially higher.
Freezing weather has also driven demand for oil in parts of the United States, though the snow is likely to melt far quicker than the frustration in Iran.
The S&P 500 hit a milestone yesterday, closing above 2,700 for the first time. Reuters' Fred Katayama has more.
The S&P 500 topped the 2,700 mark for the first time Wednesday. Tech and energy shares led the rally. Stocks held their gains after the release of the Federal Reserve's December minutes, which indicated concerns over low inflation. People's United Wealth Management Chief Investment Officer John Traynor.
Tech stocks are the leaders because of earnings. You know, they're showing great earnings. Our expectations are high this year for them. So investors are going back into the names that they know worked best last year. Absolutely.
SCANA's shares jumped higher. Dominion Energy is buying the troubled utility. It's an all-stock deal worth nearly $15 billion, including debt. Dominion shares fell. MoneyGram shares dropped. Alibaba affiliate Ant Financial scrapped its deal to buy the money transfer company. A U.S. government panel blocked the sale over national security concerns. In economics news, a surge in orders boosted U.S. factory activity more than expected in December, and construction spending rose to a record high in November. Tech and healthcare shares propelled the market solidly higher in Europe.
NBC News reported this morning that the Dow Jones Industrial Average broke the 25,000 mark as investors rode a wave of optimism resulting from strong private hiring numbers. Aaron Anderson, Senior Vice President of Research at Fisher Investments, said, quote, "We're going through these milestone numbers more quickly, but they have been steady and positive." The ADP National Employment Report was released, and whereas economists polled by Reuters had predicted an addition of 190,000 jobs to the workforce in December, the number actually ended up being 250,000, making this the largest monthly increase in jobs since last March. Tomorrow, the non-farm payrolls report is expected to be released, and Mr. Anderson says, quote, "Economic data tomorrow is not going to be tremendously spectacular, but what we're seeing is very positive growth, a good economic backdrop that gives people more confidence in corporate earnings." Now let's see what the market is doing today. In early afternoon trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 138 points at 25,061. The NASDAQ was up 12 points at 7,077. The S&P 500 was up 12 points at 2,725. Crude oil was up 45 cents at $62.08 a barrel. In the world markets, the Japanese Nikkei closed up an astounding 766 points, and the Hong Kong Hang Seng closed up 177. The London FTSE 100 closed up 25, and the DAX in Germany closed up 190. Our third and final quote of the day comes from, of course, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. "I will go peaceably and firmly to the Catholic Church, for if faith is so important to our salvation, I will seek it where true faith first began, seek it among those who received it from God Himself." Coming up next after the break in Lives of the Saints and Martyrs, we honor St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. You're listening to Crusade News.
Hey folks, have you ever heard the old adage, you need to wake up and smell the coffee? Well, it's true, and I'm here to ask you to make sure the coffee you wake up to and smell is the Crusade Channel's very own gourmet blend, Crusade Capuchin Dark Roast. Our coffee is custom roasted from the finest fair trade coffee beans and is bagged for us by the Heavenly Roast Coffee Company. Order your supply of Crusade Capuchin Dark Roast today by browsing to mikechurch.com/coffee. And don't forget the Crusade Channel coffee mugs. Place your order for delicious gourmet Crusade Channel coffee today at mikechurch.com/coffee or call 844-5-CRUSADE.
Elizabeth Ann Bailey was born in New York City in 1774, the daughter of a surgeon and his wife, who were descendants of some of the earliest settlers in New York. She suffered the loss of her mother at the age of three, and later on of her stepmother due to the breakdown of her father's second marriage. Elizabeth was raised in the Episcopal Church and married William McGee Seton, a wealthy businessman, at the age of 19. Wealthy yet generous, Elizabeth Seton exercised a ministry of care for the sick and dying. She also was a charter member and treasurer of the Society for the Relief of Poor Widows with Small Children. When William Seton's father passed away, the couple, who already had five children of their own, had to take in William's six younger siblings, aged 7 to 17. William himself suffered with tuberculosis, and after losing his wealth to an unfortunate series of events, his condition worsened and he was sent to Italy for the warmer climate, with Elizabeth and their daughter. He died in December 1803, and Elizabeth and her daughter were then received by the families of William's Italian business partners, who introduced her to the Catholic faith. Upon her return to the United States, she was received into the Catholic Church and then was confirmed by Bishop John Carroll, the first bishop in the United States. Elizabeth Seton started a school for young ladies to support herself and later established the St. Joseph's Academy and Free School to educate Catholic girls. She then founded the religious congregation known as the Sisters of Charity of St. Joseph's, which served the children of the poor. It was the first religious congregation founded in the United States, and its school was the first free Catholic school in the country. Mother Seton died on January 4, 1821, at the age of 46, and is buried in Emmitsburg, Maryland. St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, pray for us. RT reports that although the American economy seems to be progressing in a positive direction, there is one person out there who does not share the president's optimism for the future of the economy, and in fact is predicting a coming crash. That person is former U.S. Senator Ron Paul.
With his first year in office drawing to a close, the U.S. president has been talking up his economic record in typical Trump style.
The economic miracle. Created more than 2 million jobs.
Unemployment is at a 17-year low.
The stock market is at an all-time high.
Fantastic for the economy.
Our economy has already surged to 3% growth. Unemployment is at a 17-year low.
Liberated the American economy.
Our economy is doing fantastically well.
But one man who does not share President Trump's optimism is former U.S. Congressman Ron Paul, and he joins us live now from Texas. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. So what do you make of Trump's record? Why, in your view, is it not perhaps as positive as the figures seem to suggest? His supporters would say the stock market's going up, jobs are being created. Is that not worthy of praise?
Well, if it is, if we're all true, there's partial truth there. Things are a little bit better. If you're in the stock market and a wealthy person, you're doing quite well. But what we're forgetting here when we listen to this rhetoric of all this optimism is that there's a large segment of our population that's having a difficult time. We have two types of society here, the lower 50% and the top 10 or 15%. And the economy is doing well for the wealthy, but not for the poor. And where there is prosperity and more jobs, it depends on debt. Yes, an individual can feel very good if they have a line of credit to the bank, but eventually that line of credit runs out. We in this country benefit because we have the reserve currency of the world. We can run up a lot of debt and we can spend a lot of money. And even with that, we've had a great deal of difficulty these last 8 years trying to get out of the recession. And I quite frankly don't believe we're really out of that recession, but believe me, we have a lot more debt. It's self-limiting, and I think before this year is out, the amount of debt that we have is going to be a great burden because interest rates are creeping up. And all of a sudden, that's going to make our budgetary problems very difficult to handle.
You went further than that in an interview recently, saying that the system is coming apart, very direct language. What did you actually mean by that? Because there are those who would disagree with you, saying that, you know, the impending economic meltdown is always coming, but the system just keeps going on, does it not?
Yes, that is true. You know, in Austrian economics, which I follow, which is quite a bit different from Keynesian economics or socialist economics, it teaches that you can see the direction of an economy and predict, bubbles, but you can't predict timing. We do know that if you have a central bank and they have credibility and that they can print money and seem to stimulate things, we know that there's a bubble coming. And I see everything we do as a big bubble. And all those QEs that we have dealt with in these last 8 years have just created a huge bubble, and everything is in excess, whether it's our military budget, our overseas engagements, whether it's the welfare state, and that bubble will come to an end. But Austrian economics say you may know the direction of the country, but you don't know whether it's going to be tomorrow or next year. There will be some event that will pop up, and the fragility of the economy will all of a sudden become apparent, and there'll be a rush to the exits, and this has to be reversed. We will have to pay for our extravagance.
That type of breakup, as you say, it would be like what the Soviet Union experienced. What kind of comparison did you make and why?
Well, the way I see this is in economic terms, and my understanding is that it wasn't that our military buildup in the United States that brought the Soviet system down. What happened was the Soviets were working with a system that we as freedom people and free markets saw it as totally unviable. Socialism and fascism and communism, it's not viable. And eventually, you know, it can be held together with force, but eventually it ends. And Keynesianism and deficit financing and Federal Reserves and welfarism and the militarism, it's not viable. So I say it's coming to an end. And although I have said it's going to be, we're going to have a sudden cataclysmic end, which is sort of what happened to the Soviet system, it's not going to be identical. And I pointed out that it was different. There was sort of a secession movement in some of those countries left the Soviet system. And our states aren't probably going to break up, but I do sincerely believe that we will no longer be able to afford our empire around the world. So our empire that we have out there, although we don't claim ownership to it, it's a lot of money and a lot of influence, and we threaten with weapons, and we use sanctions to hold our empire together. I think that's coming to an end.
So can the economy be turned around, you think, or is it just going to come to a dire end, as you say?
Well, I always wished that you could work through the system, and that's why I went into Congress, but I never had an illusion to think, oh, they're going to listen to me and I'll get some help there and we will be smart and we will quit printing the money and balance the budget and bring our troops home. No, I never expected that. It's not going to happen. No, I think the turnaround will come, and I'm optimistic on the long run because there are more people like myself who are trying to promote the ideas of liberty and sound economic policy. So, no, I think the big crash will come first, and then it'll be up for grabs. I do think that we who believe in less government and the free market system, we have a crack at it, and we definitely will have to have monetary reform because it's very precarious right now, and that's why you see the dollar getting weaker, and other countries that are talking about an alternative currency. That is not easy to do, but there's talk of that, and I think eventually it will come about because I think the dollar will fail.
Thank you very much for your time and thoughts this hour. Always good to have you in the program. Ron Paul, former U.S. congressman and presidential candidate in two elections. Thank you very much.
Today in the U.K. is being called by some Fat Cat Thursday, the day in which the bosses of Britain's top companies may have already earned what the typical worker will make in an entire year. Sounds a little bit like class warfare to me, but Reuters' Lawrence White has more on this.
For workers in Britain struggling into work on the third official working day of the year, there's some bad news. Their bosses could have already earned in those 3 days their entire annual salary for the year. That's the headline finding of a report released today on what's being dubbed Fat Cat Thursday. I'm Lawrence White, UK banking reporter for Thomson Reuters, here in Canary Wharf, in the heart of London's financial district. The report shows that for the average worker in Britain who's earning around £28,800, their boss could already have made more than their annual salary in the first 3 working days of this year. So the report actually shows some positive news in that high CEO pay has fallen by 17% this year. That's largely as a result of pressure from the public, from the government, and from unions and shareholders. So there is a sort of mounting public pressure around high pay, which has resulted in some change, but the report says it hasn't gone far enough. So we combed through filings from 13 banks to show that the US banks are paying more for their top bankers than those than the main British banks. So Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, top of the heap, with paying around $1.5 million each per year to their top bankers in Britain. That compares to around $1 million for HSBC and Barclays for their top bankers. That's mainly because the Wall Street banks, after the 2008 crisis, got their act together quicker and went back towards their old ways of high pay. So there are two main initiatives that will shine even more of a spotlight on high pay in Britain. The first, brought in by British Prime Minister Theresa May last year, is that from April this year, companies will have to disclose the gap between what they pay men and what they pay women. And obviously for some companies, that gap could be rather wide and embarrassing. The second initiative is around the gap between what companies pay their average worker and what they pay their CEOs. So from the middle of this year, companies are going to have to tell us what they're paying their average worker and how that compares to what they're paying the CEO. And there's going to be a name and shame policy where companies that experience more than 20% of shareholders voting against their CEO pay will be put on a register and have to just be named publicly.
Tragedy struck in South Africa, leaving at least 18 people dead after a passenger train hit a truck at a level crossing. Reuters reports.
The wreckage of a deadly train crash in South Africa. At least a dozen people killed when the train was apparently derailed after hitting a truck at a level crossing. That's according to South African Transport Minister Joe Mazwanganyi.
You can see for yourself that the truck driver was taking chances. He thought that he was going to pass through. Little did he know that the train was going to hit him. That has costed lots of lives.
Emergency services and rail authorities were not immediately able to confirm the circumstances of the crash. The train, travelling from Port Elizabeth to Johannesburg, was carrying 700 passengers. Mr. Mazwanganyi said 12 people had been killed and 268 people injured, four of them critically. He added that the driver of the truck had survived and police were investigating.
Eternal rest grant to the dead, O Lord. ABC News reports that a new salacious tell-all book entitled Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House by journalist Michael Wolff is replete with inside information from former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon about what went on behind closed doors during his time working for the president and his impressions of those with whom the president has surrounded himself. In response, President Trump has sent Mr. Bannon a cease and desist letter, threatening legal action against his former chief strategist.
In that bombshell book, Rocking the White House, Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House, it features blistering attacks on the president and his family from Steve Bannon, the strategist by Trump's side during the campaign and the early days in the White House. It has drawn a furious response from President Trump, now threatening legal action against Bannon. And our senior White House correspondent, Cecilia Vega, is here with the explosive details. Cecilia, the White House on a war footing over this.
Hey, George, good morning. The president's lawyers are demanding Steve Bannon stop making what they call disparaging comments about the president and his family. And just now they sent a letter to the author accusing him of defamation, demanding he not release this book. Behind closed doors of the White House, President Trump allegedly critiqued his top aides, calling son-in-law Jared Kushner a suck-up, senior advisor Kellyanne Conway a crybaby, and former press secretary Sean Spicer stupid. At the center of the fallout, a man once in the inner circle, who Trump has called a friend, former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon.
There's nobody we think higher of than President Trump.
Bannon offering his own bombshell accusations about that now infamous Trump Tower meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, campaign chairman Paul Manafort, and a Russian lawyer whom they were told had dirt on Hillary Clinton. Bannon called it treasonous, unpatriotic, and he said Team Trump, quote, should have called the FBI immediately. All in a tell-all book, Fire and Fury, by veteran journalist Michael Wolff, who had unprecedented access to the White House. In it, Bannon says there's a 0% chance Donald Jr. didn't take the attendees of that Trump Tower sit-down to meet the president, despite the president's insistence he knew nothing about it. Bannon taking aim at Trump's daughter, too, saying Ivanka was a non-event on the campaign, and that, quote, she became a White House staffer, and that's when people suddenly realized she's dumb as a brick. 312 pages pulling the curtain back on the Trump administration, saying Ivanka also discussed the possibility of running for president herself. The White House calls it trashy tabloid fiction.
I think furious, disgusted would probably certainly fit when you make such outrageous claims and completely false claims against the president, his administration, and his family.
But just months ago, Trump lavished praise on Bannon.
I have a very good relationship, as you know, with Steve Bannon. Steve's been a friend of mine for a long time. I like Steve a lot.
Now the president going public with an unprecedented rebuke, saying, quote, Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Overnight on Breitbart News Radio, Bannon praised the president.
The president of the United States is a great man. You know, I support him day in and day out.
Wolff goes on to write that almost everyone on the Trump campaign thought Mr. Trump would not only not be president, they thought he should not be president. Even the president himself, Wolff says, didn't think he would win. And his wife was so opposed to the idea, she was in tears when he did, though her spokeswoman disputes it. No one is off limits. The book says Ivanka Trump makes fun of her father's comb-over hair, and the notoriously germophobic president ordered White House staff not to touch anything, especially his toothbrush, reprimanding housekeeping staff, saying, if my shirt is on the floor, it's because I want it on the floor, and that he had a longtime fear of being poisoned. That's one reason he ate so much McDonald's. The food was pre-made, and no one knew he was coming.
Now, the author says that he spoke to more than 200 people for this book. The White House is trying to downplay the access that he had here, saying he was on the grounds of the White House only about a dozen times, and about 95% of that was at the request of Steve Bannon. Aides here say the author did have one brief conversation over the phone with the president after the election, George, but we can't verify any of this ourselves because they refused to release the White House visitor logs.
Right, see, but even a dozen visits to the White House in the first year is actually quite a lot for an outside journalist. And another matter is this was all happening. We learned overnight that the president has disbanded this commission that he had set up to back up his false claims about voter fraud in the last election.
Exactly. They say that so many states are refusing to participate in the investigation. That's why they disbanded it. You'll remember this was set up by the president after the election based on these unfounded claims that millions voted the election illegally. George, there is no widespread evidence of voter fraud.
Okay, Cecilia Vega, thanks very much.
In this Celestial Musings, it's the 11th day of Christmas. Merry Christmas. Earlier, I promised you the rest of the story of the unfortunate fruitcake saga. So here you go. As I was preparing to take my 20-year-old daughter back to school the other day, we stopped off at the grocery store. As we were getting ready to check out, she said to me, "Now it's time to get my fruitcake." "What do you mean?" I asked. "Well, when I went to ask Dad for a slice of his fruitcake, it was all gone." I told her that she waited too long to ask. We Youngbloods love our fruitcake, and my mother sends us a delectable one made by monks every year. So I asked the young man in the bakery section, "Where might we find fruitcakes?" And he walked over to a couple of areas where they had been, but no longer were. It appeared they had no more fruitcakes. On the 9th day of Christmas. But don't you fear. 6 weeks out, they are full of red and pink and white candies for, you guessed it, Valentine's Day. 6 weeks out. Christmas isn't over yet, my friends. Keep celebrating, and if you can find yourself a fruitcake yet, consider yourself lucky. As for my daughter, she had to settle for a vintage 100-year anniversary tin of moon pies. I can't say she was too disappointed. Good thing the monastery 20 minutes up the road makes fruitcakes. She has a birthday coming up later this month, and that might just be her birthday cake. But don't worry, she isn't listening to her mama. She's at work. You might know, but it'll still be a surprise to her. Are you taking notes, Mitter Youngblood? For more news headlines, follow me at my Twitter handle, @CrusadeNewscast. One more follower, and I'll have 100. Keep yourself tuned into the Veritas Radio Network for king-sized truth from radio-sized speakers. Coming up next, The True Money Show. Celeste Youngblood signing off for the Crusade Channel. Serving you, serving truth.
You've just heard Crusade Channel News. Live on your news, talk, and saints leader, the Crusade Channel. And did you know that all newscasts are available as podcasts on CrusadeChannel.com and on our free app available in the Google Play and iTunes stores? Surprised?
If I woke up tomorrow with my head sewn to the carpet, I wouldn't be more surprised than I am right now.
Crusade Channel News. News you can trust. Because the truth can be trusted.